And this relation is called sometimes the I, thou, we relation. It is obvious that the thou and the we are supplements to Descartes' ego. The question whether the fundamental inadequacy of Descartes' ego can be disposed of by any supplements, and whether it is not necessary to return to a more fundamental beginning or to the natural beginning. The phenomenon which is now called the I-thou-we relation was known to the classics by the name of friendship. When speaking to a friend, I address him in the second person, but philosophic or scientific analysis is not speaking to a friend, that's to say to this individual here and now, but speaking to anyone concerned with such analysis. Such analysis cannot be meant to be a substitute for living together as friends. It can at best only point to such living together or arouse a desire for it. When speaking about someone with whom I have a close relation, I call him my friend. I do not call him my thou. Adequate speaking about in analytical or objective speech must be grounded in and continue the manner of speaking about which is inherent in actual life. By speaking of the thou instead of the friend, I'm trying to preserve in objective speech what cannot be preserved in objective speech. I'm trying to objectivate something which is incapable of being objectivated. I am trying to preserve in speaking about what can be actual only in speaking to. That means I do injustice to the phenomena. I'm untrue to the phenomena. I miss the concrete. The character of classical political philosophy appears with the greatest clarity from Plato's Laws, which is Plato's political work par excellence. The Laws are a conversation about law and political things in general between an old Athenian stranger, an old Cretan, and an old Spartan. The conversation takes place on the island of Crete. At the beginning, one receives the impression that the Athenian has come to Crete in order to study there the best laws. For if it is true that the good is identical with the ancestral, the best laws for a Greek would be the oldest Greek laws, and these were the great Cretan laws. But the equation of the good with the ancestral is not tenable if the first ancestors were not gods or sons of gods or pupils of gods. Hence, the Cretans believed that their laws were originated by Zeus, who instructed his son Minos, the Cretan legislator. The laws open with an expression of this belief. It appears, however, immediately afterward that this belief has no other ground, no better ground than a saying of Homer, and the poets are of questionable veracity, as well as what the Cretans themselves say.
And the Cretans were famous for their lack of veracity. However this may be, 2 or 3 minutes after the beginning, the correlation shifts from the question of the origins of the Cretan laws to the question of their intrinsic worth. The code given by a god, by a being of superhuman excellence, must be unqualifiedly good. Very slowly, very circumspectly, does the Athenian stranger approach this grave question. To begin with, he limits himself to criticizing the principle underlying the Cretan or the Spartan codes by criticizing not these codes, but a poet, a man without authority, and in addition an expatriate who embraced the same thing. In the sequel, the philosopher attacks not yet the Cretan and Spartan codes, but the interpretation of these codes, which has been set forth by his interlocutor. He does not begin to criticize these venerable codes explicitly,
until he has appeared to a presumed Cretan or Spartan law which permits such criticism under certain conditions, under conditions which are fulfilled to some extent in the present conversation. According to that presumed law, all must say with one voice and one mouth that all the laws of Crete or of Sparta are good because they are God-given, and no one is suffered to say anything different. But an old citizen may utter a criticism of an allegedly divine law before a magistrate of his own age if no young men are present. By this time it has become clear to the reader that the Athenian has not come to Crete in order to study there the best laws, but rather in order to introduce into Crete new laws and institutions, truly good laws and institutions. These laws and institutions will prove to be, to a considerable extent, of Athenian origin. It seems that the Athenian, being the son of a highly civilized society, has embarked on the venture of civilizing a rather uncivilized society. Therefore, he has to apprehend that his suggestions will be odious, not only as innovations, but above all as foreign, as Athenian. Deep-seated old animosities and suspicions will be aroused by his recommendations. He begins his explicit criticism with a remark about the connection between certain Cretan and Spartan institutions and the practice of homosexuality in these cities. The Spartan, racing in defense of his fatherland, does not indeed defend homosexuality, but turning to the offensive, rebukes the Athenians for their excessive drinking. The Athenian is thus given a perfect excuse for recommending the introduction of the Athenian institution of banquets. He is compelled to defend that institution. By defending it, he acts the part not of a civilizing philosopher, who being a philosopher is a philanthropist, but of the patriot. He acts in a way which is perfectly understandable to his interlocutors and perfectly respectable in their eyes. He attempts to show that wine drinking and even drunkenness, if it is practiced in well-presided banquets, is conducive to education in temperance or moderation. This speech about wine forms the bulk of the first two books of Plato's Laws. Only after the speech about wine has been concluded does the Athenian turn to the question of the beginning of political life, to a question which is the true beginning of his political theme. The speech about wine appears to be the introduction to political philosophy. We have to raise this question. Why does the Platonic dialogue about politics and laws begin with such an extensive conversation about wine? What is the artistic or logographic necessity demanding this? The proper interlocutors in a conversation about laws are old citizens of communities famous for their laws, for their obedience and allegiance to their old laws. Such men understand best what living under laws, living in laws, means. They are the perfect incarnation of the spirit of laws, of lawfulness and law-abidingness. But their very virtue becomes a defect if there is no longer a question of preserving old laws, but of introducing new and better ones. Their habits and their competence make these men impervious to suggestions of improvement. The Athenian induces them to participate in a conversation about wine drinking, about a pleasure that is forbidden to them by their old laws. The talk about wine drinking is a kind of vicarious enjoyment of wine, especially since wine drinking is a forbidden pleasure. Perhaps the talk reminds the two old men of secret and pleasurable transgressions of their own.
The effect of the talk about wine is therefore similar to the effect of actual wine drinking. It loosens their tongues, it makes them young, it makes them bold, daring, willing to innovate. They must not actually drink wine, that this would impair their judgment. They must drink wine not in deed, but in speech. But this means that wine drinking educates to boldness, to courage, and not to moderation. And yet wine drinking was said to be conducive to moderation. Let us therefore consider the other partner in the conversation, the Athenian philosopher. To doubt the sacredness of the ancestral means to appeal from the ancestral to the natural. It means to transcend all human traditions, nay, the whole dimension of the merely human. It means to learn to look down on the human as something inferior, or, in Plato's language, to leave the cave. But by leaving the cave, one loses sight of the city, of the whole political sphere. But if the philosopher is to give political guidance, he must return to the cave, from the light of the sun to the world of shadow. His perception must be dim. His mind must undergo obfuscation. The vicarious enjoyment of wine through a conversation about wine, which enlarges the horizon of the law-bred old citizens, limits the horizon of the philosopher. But this obfuscation, this acceptance of the political perspective, this adoption of the language of political man, is perhaps the most noble exercise of the virtue of moderation.
For moderation is not a virtue of thought. Plato likens philosophy to madness. It's the very opposite of sobriety or moderation. Thought must be not moderate, but fearless, not to say shameless.
But moderation is a virtue controlling the philosopher's speech. I have suggested that the Athenian stranger had gone to Crete in order to civilize an uncivilized society, and that he had done this out of philanthropy. But does not philanthropy begin at home? Did he not have more pressing duties to perform at home? What kind of man is that Athenian stranger? The laws begin with the word God. They are the only Platonic dialogue which begins in that manner. There is one and only one Platonic dialogue which ends with the word God, and that is the Apology of Socrates. In the Apology of Socrates, an old Athenian philosopher called Socrates defends himself against the charge of impiety, of not believing that the gods worshipped by the city of Athens exist. It seems then that there is a conflict between philosophy and accepting the gods of the city. In the Laws, an old Athenian philosopher recommends a law about impiety which renders impossible the conflict between philosophy and the city. The gods whose existence is to be admitted by every citizen of the city of the laws are beings whose existence can be demonstrated. That old Athenian philosopher of the Apology of Socrates was condemned to death by the city of Athens. He was given an opportunity to escape from prison. He refused to avail himself of this opportunity. His refusal was not based on an appeal to a categoric imperative, demanding passive obedience without ifs and buts. His refusal was based on a deliberation, on a prudential consideration of what was the right thing to do in the circumstances. One of the circumstances was Socrates' old age. We are forced to wonder, therefore, how Socrates would have decided if he had been 30 or 40 instead of 70. Another circumstance was the inavailability of a proper place of exile. Where should he flee? He seems to have a choice between decent cities nearby, where his life would be unbearable, since he would be known as a fugitive from justice, and a chaotic country far away.
Where the prevailing lack of discipline would make his life miserable. The disjunction is obviously incomplete. There were, after all, decent cities far away, for instance, on the island of Crete, which is mentioned as a decent place in the very deliberation in question. We are entitled to infer that if Soganes had fled, he would have gone to Crete. The laws tell us what he would have done in Crete after his arrival. He would have brought the blessings of Athens, Athenian laws, Athenian institutions, banquets, and philosophy to Crete. Incidentally, when Aristotle speaks about Plato's laws, he takes it for granted that the chief character of the laws is Soganes.
Escaping to Crete, living in Crete, was the alternative to dying in Athens. But Soganes chose to die in Athens, which means Soganes preferred to sacrifice himself in order to preserve philosophy in Athens, rather than to introduce philosophy into Crete. If the danger to the future of philosophy in Athens had been less great, he might have chosen to flee to Crete.
His choice was a political choice of the highest order. It did not consist in the simple subsumption of his case under a simple, universal, and unalterable rule. But let us return after this long story to the beginning of Plato's law. If the originator of the Cretan laws or of any other laws is not a god, the cause of laws must be human beings, the human legislator. There is a variety of types of human legislator. The legislator has a different character in a democracy, in an oligarchy, in a monarchy. The legislator is the governing body, and the character of the governing body depends on the whole social political order, the politeia. Politeia is usually translated by constitution. The translation is misleading. I prefer to translate it by regime. The cause of laws is a regime. Therefore, the guiding theme of political philosophy is a regime rather than the laws. Regime becomes the guiding theme of political thought when the derivative or questionable character of laws has been realized. There are a number of biblical terms which can be properly translated by law. There is no biblical equivalent to regime, politeia. Regime is the order, the form, which gives society its character. Regime is therefore a specific manner of life. Regime is a form of life as living together. The manner of living of society and in society. Since this manner depends decisively on the predominance of human beings of a certain type, on the manifest domination of society by human beings of a certain type, for example, priests, noblemen, business, peasants, workers, or various combinations of these. Regime means that whole which we today are in the habit of viewing primarily in a fragmentized form. Regime means simultaneously the form of life of a society, its style of life, its moral taste, form of society, form of state, form of government, spirit of laws. The expression way of life, as part of the American expression American way of life, comes rather close to what the classics meant by regime. For in that American expression, it is understood that the way of life of society is decisively determined by the political order, even by the Constitution. We may try to articulate the simple and unitary thought that expresses itself in the term politeia as follows. Life is an activity which is directed towards some goal. Social life is an activity which is directed towards such a goal as can be pursued only by society. But in order to pursue a specific goal at its comprehensive form. Society must be organized, ordered, constructed, constituted in a manner which is in accordance with that goal.
This, however, means that the authoritative human beings in society must be akin to that goal. There is a variety of regimes. Each regime raises a claim, explicitly or implicit, which extends beyond the boundaries of any given society. These claims conflict, therefore, with each other. There is a variety of conflicting regimes. Thus, the regimes themselves,
and not any preoccupation of mere intellectuals, cause us to wonder which of the given conflicting regimes is better, and ultimately, which regime is the best regime. The classical political philosophy is guided by the question of the best regime. This question presupposes, in the first place, that one does not know without further ado what the best regime is, what its character and its character and its properties are. And secondly, and above all, that the best regime does not exist everywhere and at all times. In fact, the desired best regime exists essentially local in speech and recent projects and a model that has been figured out. It is not of intent to exist terrible. Indeed, the best regime would not cease to be the best regime, even if it has never existed, or if it will never exist. Indeed, it is essentially something which all men, or at least all serious, respectable, decent, wealthy men would wish for, or for which they would pray.
The best regime is an object of wish or prayer. It is intended in every political action, since every political action is directed towards apparent or real good. In order to be the object of a reasonable wish, the best regime must be possible. It is not sufficient, as Kant thought, to show that the best regime is not impossible. It is necessary to give a positive proof of its possibility through consideration of the nature of man and the nature of civil society. In order to be the object of a reasonable wish, the best regime must be truly the best. It is best if it is conducive, in the highest degree, to arete, the specific excellence of man, let us say, virtue. That toward which the best regime is ordered is the excellence of man as man. It is a complete misunderstanding to say that the best regime which Plato and Aristotle had in mind is the best of Greek society. The best regime is possible only under the most favorable conditions. And these conditions are perhaps available
in the region of the Mediterranean rather than anywhere else. That to say, the best regime is possible only very rarely. The actualization of the best regime is, generally speaking, extremely improbable. This does not impair its importance as a standard of judgment, or judgment of the actual regimes, the common regimes, or distinguishing between better and worse regimes, between bearable and altogether unbearable regimes. The study of the ordinary rests on a fundamental premise which may be stated as follows. The best is not identical with the just. The best is just only under the most favorable conditions. Under more or less unfavorable conditions,
more or less imperfect social orders are a demand of justice. Hence, the attempt to establish the best regime is almost always unjust. The best is determined unchangeably by the unchangeable nature of man. But the just is almost as changeable as circumstances are changeable, which amounts to saying that the classical political philosophy is at the opposite pole of all doctrinarism. The best regime was perhaps never actual. Perhaps it will never be actual, in spite of the fact that it is possible. Its actualization depends on the coming together, on the coincidence of things, which have a tendency to move away from each other, for example, on the coincidence of philosophy and political power. The actualization of the best regime depends on chance. Human nature is enslaved in so many ways by wants and circumstances that it is almost a miracle if an individual achieves the highest. What can one expect of society? The peculiar manner of being of the best regime, namely that while being superior to all actual regimes, it lacks actuality, has its reason in the dual nature of man, in the fact that man is an in-between being between brutes and gods. The practical meaning of the notion of the best regime, which, to repeat, is a central and guiding concept of classical political philosophy, the practical meaning of this notion appears most clearly when we consider the ambiguity of the term good citizen. Aristotle suggests two entirely different definitions of the good citizen. In his more popular Constitution of Athens, he suggests that the good citizen is a man who serves his country well, without any regard to the difference of regimes, who serves his country well in fundamental indifference to the change of regimes. The good citizen, in a word, is a patriotic citizen, the man whose loyalty belongs first and last to his fatherland. In his less popular Politics, Aristotle says that there is not the good citizen without qualification. For what it means to be a good citizen depends entirely on the regime. A good citizen in Nazi Germany would be a bad citizen elsewhere. But whereas good citizen is relative to the regime, good man does not have such relativity. And the meaning of good man is always and everywhere the same about among decent people.
The good man is identical with the good citizen only in one case, in the case of the best regime.
For only in the best regime is the good of the regime and the good of the good man identical, virtue. This amounts to saying that in his Politics, Aristotle questions the proposition that patriotism is enough. From the point of view of the patriot, the fatherland is more important than any difference of regimes. From the point of view of the patriot, he who prefers any regime to the fatherland is a partisan, if not a traitor. Aristotle says, in effect, that the partisan sees deeper than the patriot, but that only one kind of partisans is superior to the patriot. This is the partisan of virtue. One can express Aristotle's thought as follows. Patriotism is not enough for the same reason for which the most doting mother is happier if her child is good than if he is bad. A mother loves her child because he is her own. She loves what is her own, but she also loves the good. All human love stands under the law to be both love of one's own and love of the good. And there is necessarily a tension between one's own and the good, a tension which may well lead to a break, be it only the breaking of a heart. The relation between
one's own and the good finds its political expression in the relation between the fatherland and the regime. From this it follows that the fatherland or the nation is the good matter, whereas the regime is the more fair, the form. The classic sense of heretofore is higher in dignity than the matter.
One may call this view idealism. The practical meaning of this idealism is that the good is of higher dignity than one's own, or that the best regime is a higher consideration than the fatherland. Classical political philosophy is today exposed to two very common objections, the raising of which requires neither originality nor intelligence, nor even erudition.
The objections are these. First, classical political philosophy is anti-democratic and anti-bad.
Secondly, classical political philosophy is based on classical natural philosophy or on classical cosmology. And this basis has been proven to be untrue by the success of modern natural science. To speak first of the classics' attitude toward democracy, the premise is the classics are good and democracy is good do not validate the conclusion, hence the classics were good democrats. It would be silly to deny that the classics rejected democracy as an inferior kind of regime. They were not blind to its advantages. The severest indictment of democracy that ever was written occurs in the eighth book of Plato. Sparta, he would have been exposed as an infant. Yet Plato did not regard this consideration as decisive, for he was concerned not only with the possibility of philosophy, but likewise with a stable political order that would be congenial to moderate political causes. And such an order, he thought, depends on the predominance of old families. More generally, the classics rejected democracy because they thought that the aim of human life, and hence of social life, is not freedom, but virtue. Freedom as a good is ambiguous because it is freedom for good as well as for evil. Now, virtue emerges normally only through education. That's to say, through the formation of character, through habituation. And this requires leisure on the part of both parents and children. But leisure in its turn requires some degree of wealth. More specifically, a kind of wealth whose acquisition or administration is compatible with leisure. Now, as regards wealth, it so happens, as Aristotle observes, there is always a minority of well-to-do people and a majority of the poor. And this strange coincidence will last forever because there is a kind of natural scarcity. It is for this reason that democracy or rule of the majority is governed by the uneducated. And no one in his senses would wish to live under such a government. This classical argument would not be stringent if men did not need education in order to acquire a firm adhesion to virtue. It's no accident that it was Jean-Jacques Rousseau who taught that all knowledge which men need in order to live virtuously is supplied by the conscience, the preserve of the simple souls rather than of other men. Man is sufficiently equipped by nature for the good life. Man is by nature good. But the same Jean-Jacques was compelled to develop a scheme of education which very few people could financially afford. On the whole, the view has prevailed that democracy must become ruled by the educated, and this good will be achieved by universal education. But universal education presupposes that the economy of scarcity has given way to an economy of plenty. And the economy of plenty presupposes the emancipation of technology from moral and political control. The essential difference between our view and the classical view consists then not in a difference of moral attitude, not in a different understanding of justice. We too, even our communist coexistence, think that it is just to give equal things to equal people and unequal things to people of unequal merit. The difference between the classicals and us in regard to democracy consists exclusively in a different estimate of the virtues of technology. But we are not entitled to say that the classical view has been refuted. The implicit prophecy that the emancipation of technology, of the arts, from moral and political control would lead to disaster or to the dehumanization of man has not yet been refuted. Nor can we say that democracy has found a solution to the problem of education. In the first place, what is called education very frequently does not mean education proper, that's to say the formation of character, but rather instruction and training. Secondly, to the extent to which the formation of character is indeed intended, there exists a very dangerous tendency to identify the good man with a good sport, the cooperative fellow, the regular guy. That's to say an overemphasis on certain parts of social virtue and a corresponding neglect of those virtues which mature if they do not flourish in privacy, not to say in solitude. By educating people who cooperate with each other in a friendly spirit, one does not yet educate nonconformists, people who are prepared to stand alone, to fight alone, rugged individualists. Democracy has not yet found a defense against the creeping conformism and the ever-increasing invasion of privacy which it fosters. People who would look down from a star might find that the difference between democracy and communism is not quite as great as it appears to be when one considers exclusively the doubtless very important question of civil and political liberties. Now, to the extent to which democracy is aware of these dangers, to the same extent, it sees itself compelled to think of elevating its level and its possibilities by a return to the classics notion of education, a kind of education which can never be thought of as mass education, but only as higher and highest education of those who are by nature fit for it. It would be an understatement to call it royal education. Yet, granting that there are no valid moral or political objections to classical political philosophy, is that political philosophy not bound up with an antiquated cosmology? Does not the very question of the nature of man point to the question of the nature of the whole, and therewith to one or the other specific cosmology? Whatever the significance of modern natural science may be, it has not succeeded in giving us a better understanding of what is human in man. To understand man in the light of the whole means for modern natural science to understand man in the light of the subhuman. But in that light, man as man is wholly unintelligible. Classical philosophy viewed man in a different light. Classical political philosophy was originated by Socrates. And Socrates was so far from being committed to a specific cosmology that his knowledge was knowledge of ignorance. Knowledge of ignorance is not ignorance. It is knowledge of the elusive character of truth, of the elusive character of the whole. Classical philosophy viewed man in the light of the mysterious character of the whole. It held, therefore, that we know better the situation of man as man than we know the ultimate causes of that situation. We may also say that classical philosophy viewed man in the light of the unchangeable ideas, which means of the fundamental and permanent problems. This analysis of man, and not a specific cosmology, is the basis of classical political philosophy. This foundation is so far from having been rendered questionable by modern natural science or by modern thought in general, that it is confirmed by the failure or lapse of modern thought. Permit me to give you in conclusion the barest sketch of what appears to me to be the theoretic foundation of classic political philosophy. The whole is the totality of the parts. The whole eludes us, but we know some parts. We possess partial knowledge of parts. The knowledge which we possess is characterized by a fundamental dualism which has never been overcome. At one pole, we find knowledge of homogeneity, above all in arithmetic, but also in the other branches of mathematics, and derivatively in all productive arts or crafts. At the opposite pole, we find knowledge of heterogeneity, and in particular, of heterogeneous ends. The highest form of this kind of knowledge is the art of the statesman and of the educator. The latter kind of knowledge is superior to the former for these reasons. In the first place, as knowledge of the ends of human life, it is knowledge of what makes human life complete or whole. It is therefore knowledge of a whole. It is a kind of exercise in understanding the problem of the whole. And secondly, knowledge of the ends of man implies knowledge of the human soul. And the human soul is the only part of the whole which is open to the whole and therefore more akin to the whole than anything else is. But this knowledge, the political art in the highest sense, is not knowledge of the whole. It seems that knowledge of the whole would have to combine somehow the political knowledge in the highest sense with knowledge of homogeneity in the sense of mathematics. And this combination is not at our disposal. We are therefore constantly tempted to force the issue by imposing unity on the phenomena, by absolutizing either knowledge of homogeneity or knowledge of ends. We are constantly attracted and deluded by two opposite charms. The charm of competence, which is engendered by mathematics and everything akin to mathematics, and the charm of humble awe, of what Plato called piety, which is engendered by meditations on the human soul and its experiences. Philosophy, as the ancients understood it, is characterized by the gentle, if firm, refusal to succumb to either charm. Pascal has said that we know too little to be dogmatists and too much to be skeptics. He believed that this true and beautiful sentence constitutes a refutation of philosophy. But according to Socrates or Plato, this sentence supplies the only possible legitimation of philosophy. Knowledge of ignorance does not legitimate reason's disavowal of reason. It only legitimates the resolve to continue in the quest for clarity or in investigation. Pascal's resolve would appear, in the eyes of Plato or Socrates, a softness of the soul. Not softness, abandon, or despair is called for by man's nature and his condition as we know it, but the endurance, courage, or manliness which is necessarily accompanied and sustained by eros, sapere aude.